Let's go to Luke 17, and I want to look at the text. So one of the things when you're studying the Gospels that jumps out to me is, number one, Luke actually records the most parables of Jesus, and he also gives us some pretty unique parables, he gives us parables that are unique to his Gospel. That you don't read in the others. Luke shares with us 23 different parables throughout his text. 23, 24, depending on how, there's a one that's kind of debatable whether it's a parable or not. He gives us these different teachings of Christ. Now, when I say the word parable, what does that word mean? It's yeah, so that's kind of the traditional way that I remember hearing it. It's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. The word really means, you think of like parallel lines. You know, it's when you take two things, you lay them side by side as a comparison. And so as Jesus tells us, say, the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is one that's really well known. Well, is the parable really about the Good Samaritan? I mean, yes and no, not really. What's the parable about?
Who's your neighbor?
What's that?
Who's your neighbor?
That's the big question you ask. And it's a challenge for us to serve like the Good Samaritan did. Right? He's not just giving us that information about a Good Samaritan. It's to teach us what God expects from us. And so when you think about parables, it is this that Jesus is taking things that are common to the people, and he uses these to illustrate something deeper, something with a heavenly meaning. So let's go to Luke 17, and we're going to read this particular parable. Let's start at verse 11, and we'll read down through verse 19. So this is the English Standard Translation. It reads this way. On the way to Jerusalem, he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance and lifted up their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. When he saw them, he said to them, go and show yourselves to the priest. And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice. And he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus answered, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? And he said to him, rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well. So not a very long parable, but there's a lot here. So as we think about it, we can kind of step back into the bigger context. When we consider Luke, who was Luke?
Physician.
He was a physician. Corinthians chapter 4, I think it's verse 14, tells us in Paul's writing, he gives us that he was the beloved physician. What else do we know about him? Yes, he also wrote the book of Acts, the companion to the Gospel of Luke.
And he traveled with...
He was a fellow worker with Paul, absolutely. We're kind of missing one big thing.
He wasn't there.
Huh?
He wasn't there
at the time. He wasn't there, why? He was a Gentile. He was not a Jew. I'm still going back and thinking about this. To my knowledge, and I try to go back and consider each book, but he's the only Gentile writer of the New Testament. All the other books are written by Jews. He's the only Gentile. And he gives us two. You know, we mentioned Acts. But he also does the Gospel of Luke. So, why is that important? Well, he gives us a different perspective than the other writers does. He writes from a different perspective. Being a Gentile, not a Jew. And so you really see that when you get into the gospel. I'll spend some more time on that this morning during worship. But so it's interesting that he records this particular parable. It's the only one. It's the only gospel that gives us this parable. And as you read it, who's to focus on? Well, there's really two focuses. One is on the one who returned. And then the other focus would be on the nine who didn't. And we'll talk about those. You also notice, where does Jesus tell this parable? Where is this parable given from?
He's on his way to Jerusalem.
He's on his way. Where is he?
He also mentions Samaria and Galilee.
Yeah. So he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. So the image, at least I get in my head, is like you're walking down the road. On one side is North Carolina. The other side is South Carolina. Let's just imagine. There is a road. It's called State Line Road down near below Charlotte, right? State Line Road. And one side you have North Carolina. The other side you have South Carolina. And so I kind of get this image in my head. Here he is walking along the State Line Road. And on the north, he has Galilee. On the south, he has Samaria. Now, and so with that image in mind, what is Galilee? Well, it'd be North Carolina in this example. What is this Providence? Who grew up here?
Jesus
did.
It's what? It's
more or less his home. It's his home. That's where you find Nazareth, right? Is in Galilee. That's where it's where 11 of the 12 apostles came from.
They're more Gentile. Jerusalem would be more Jewish.
Mm-hmm. But there is a heavy Jewish population there. I agree. It is. Probably more Gentile. So it's Jews living alongside Gentiles. Samaria is a little different, though. To the south is Samaria. What do we know about Samaria?
They are mixed breed. They're not completely Gentile.
So they're biracial in the sense that the Gentiles could be biracial too, but from a biblical standpoint, it is the biracial groups of Jew and Gentile. And Samaria arose during the captivity period, the first captivity period, Assyria. Thank you. Assyria invaded the northern 10 tribes and took them captive. They took the 10 out. And they sent them other places, left a few, but then they sent their own people, the Assyrian people, back down into Samaria. And then you, over time, had Jew and Samarian and other and Syrian intermarry, along with other nations as well. And so you really have this grouping of Jew and Gentile together in families. Now, from a Jewish perspective, how did they view the Samaritans? They looked down on them even worse than they did the Gentiles. Now, they had kind of a snobbish attitude even toward Gentiles, but they really disliked the Samaritans. Why?
They weren't full of
grief. What?
Mm-hmm. Worship, not according to Moses.
And they saw them as traitors, right? As lesser because they intermarried with the Gentile nations. Now, and so you have you have a real disdain between Jew and Samaritan. They really look down on the Samaritans. And so that's the background to what's going on here. Now, in the lepers, how many are Jewish? Can you take that from the text? Nine are. There seems to be only one that is a Samaritan. All right, so just think about that as we go through this. Let's for a second talk about leprosy. So leprosy is a skin disease, and it's a pretty wide variety of diseases. It's not just one definition. You think about like cancer. When we talk about cancer today, I mean, that can mean a lot of different things, right? And depending on what kind of cancer, it can really change the prognosis, of the disease itself and how you treat it. Well, leprosy is somewhat similar. It's a term that refers to a wide range of skin diseases. Think about in biblical text, one famous leper would be Naaman in 2 Kings 5. You can go read about Naaman. He's a leper. Again, we don't know particularly what kind of leprosy he had, but we know it, he had it, and it was severe enough that he needed to search out help. So another thing that's important about leprosy is that it was highly contagious. You remember just a few years ago, we had a disease that was pretty contagious, and we went into a panic, didn't we, in our nation? And we were all out wearing masks, isolating from one another, and all this stuff. And leprosy was a highly contagious disease as well. If you go over to the book of Leviticus, chapter 13, Leviticus gives us some rules and regulations to the law of Moses of how people with leprosy were to be treated. Now, we're not going to go back and just study that chapter, but yes, ma'am.
So I was just reading that leprosy can also, one of the hallmark signs of it can also cause peripheral neuropathy. And that's one thing we always think of, the skin lesions that it can cause and how, you know, the disfigurement with that. But we don't think about the pain as far as the neuropathy, not being able to feel your hands and feet, like people who get shingles have or diabetes get. And so I just think that's interesting.
Yeah, neuropathy.
Where you can't feel your feet, or you can't, you know, that nerve.
Yeah,
pain.
It's like you lose your. Well, it's just that sense of you lose feeling or touch. And you remember how Bill Bennett suffered with that. Some of us that know Bill. He had that, and it was awful because it made it hard to walk, and so yeah, that it was when you caught it. I mean, it was severe. The other significant thing was it wasn't curable. There was no cure for it. There was no ointment to put onto your skin. No tablet to take orally. There wasn't any radiation that you could do to the skin to cure it. You couldn't just cut it away. It was a death sentence. But it was more than just a death sentence. It was an isolation sentence. Not only were you diagnosed or you were told you were going to die, but you're going to die alone. So in Leviticus chapter 13, we're given certain regulations about leprosy. How was the leper treated in the nation? What were some of the things God said that this is how they are to live?
But outside the camp.
Number one, they were outside the camp.
Now that considered unclean.
Because they were considered unclean. And it made sense because this disease, if it were allowed to just live in the camp, what's going to happen? It's going to spread. And And so, number one, they were told you have to live outside the camp. There's an interesting text when you go into the study of the nations during the time of the kings. You can read about how there were leper colonies where at least some of the lepers would get together and live kind of their own life over here to the side. What else does it say about a leper?
And they must cry out, unclean, unclean.
Yeah, so they had to stay so far away from anybody else, right? And if they were to come into contact with or come close to another Jew, they were to cry out, unclean. Can you imagine that? You remember the Scarlet Letter, right? You remember having to read that in high school? I don't know if anybody ever read the Scarlet Letter for pleasure. But I remember having to read that. And what did she have to wear? A big A, right? To let everybody know who she was. And can you imagine having a disorder and you're having to yell it out to everybody that you see? I mean, what would that be like? That'd be awful. Anything else about that Moses gives us through the law? Could you touch a leper? No. They were also forbidden what? To do at the temple. They couldn't worship. So this disorder, I mean, it wasn't just a prognosis of death, but there was so much more to it. So that's the way these lepers are living their lives. Isolated from the rest of the people, they were singled out for their disease. They weren't allowed to worship in the temple like every other Jew. When was the last time anybody ever gave them a hug? A high five. How many of those did they get in their lives? Very few. And so you have them, and the text says in verse 13 that, number one, let's notice this, at the end of verse 12 it says, who stood at a distance. All right, they knew where they were. They stood at a distance and lifted up their voices, saying what? Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. Now, what we don't get is the backstory about how they knew about Jesus. How have they gotten word about his power to heal? We have none of that in the text. So we'd only be left to assume where they got that knowledge from. But however it came, they understand who Jesus is, or at least somewhat, that he has the power to heal. And so they cry out asking for mercy. Of course, as you continue reading, he does have mercy on them. What does he tell them to do?
Need to go to the priest.
Why do they need to go to the priest?
Show them
that
they were healed.
Mm-hmm. Why would they go to the priest to do that, though?
Because that was a part of the law of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
As a leper, they have to go and the priests have to check them out. Like a doctor. The priest would.
Well, in this instance, they are, right? So it's like you ever have to get the TB test, right? And you have to do that poke in your skin, and they have to go and show it. Because you've got to demonstrate that you don't have it, right? So they were commanded, as they should have been by Jesus, to go to the priest. Now, it's interesting. As they're walking that direction, what happens? They were cleansed. And you'll notice that this isn't like one of those deals where they had to wait a while. It wasn't like in a month, you know, you were going to be all better. It was an instantaneous cleansing. I wonder what that was like. Again, I'm just left to wonder. But they're just turning and they're walking away, and all of a sudden, that skin is healed. Or whatever, you know, wherever that leprosy is held to. And it's with Moses. Who is it? Oh, man. He has the leprosy. He puts it inside his coat and takes it back out. Who did that?
One of the kings.
Well, anyway, never mind. I'm sorry. I should have had that. I had thought I had it in my head, but it escaped. That's still trapped. Just isn't as close tight as it used to be.
Doesn't Moses do that to prove power to the Pharaoh?
Yeah. Who does he do that to? Who has the leprosy? It's not Moses, is it?
No.
I thought Moses does it as a sign. He puts his hand in his sleeve and then shows he has leprosy.
Okay. So it is Moses. Okay. So I had that right in my head. I just doubted myself. So yeah, Moses does that before Pharaoh. And you remember, what does the skin look like when he brings it back out?
Like a baby's.
Yeah, like a baby's skin. Like it's completely gone. Like it looks like, look down at your skin. Does it look like a baby's skin? Has your skin changed over time? How many of us have products in here that we put on our skin all the time? Do most of us do that? To look young. We want to hold on to that look. But we know through the escape of time that doesn't happen. But I do imagine, you know, these lepers as they're leaving there and they see this revitalization, how kind of awestruck they must have been. But then we get into the heart of the message. Verse 15. The text tells us then one of them comes back to do what? To what? To glorify God. What does he do? It says he was healed. He turned back, praising God with a loud voice. This morning when I got here, our sister met me out in the parking lot. And what does she do? She's praising God with a loud voice. You can imagine how excited and how thankful this man is. It says he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. And so he comes back to worship Jesus for what's happened. Now, as we noted earlier, who is this man? I don't have his name. I don't know his history, but I do know one significant thing about him.
He's a Samaritan.
He's a Samaritan. And as we noted before, you know, Samaritans were generally hated by the Jews. And yet, he is the one who overcomes whatever past animosity that might have went through his mind. And he comes to praise Jesus. But he's the only one who does that. So I want to ask two questions as we move to this latter half of this class. The first question is, what motivated the nine to not return? Why did they not come back? Maybe, but we don't know that, right? It doesn't tell us. So we're not told exactly why they didn't come back. Now, we might can make some guesses at what motivated it. Maybe it was pride. Although, I struggle with that one because of their previous life, right? I don't know how you're a proud leper. Maybe you are. Maybe you are. But I don't know. Maybe it is pride. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's a call to like how often and how
not necessarily spend a ton of time with him once you've gotten what you wanted or once you feel like you're in a better position in life. And I think that, like, I know we don't know, I know the text doesn't give us anything, but I think the nine walking away, realizing that they're cleaned and healed, like, there's an excitement to say, like, oh, like, I'm on with my life, like, I can finally start to live, and you just sort of, like, are blinded by this moment of thankfulness and, like, excitement that you just say, I got what I wanted, and you walk away from who gave it to you. And I've always, like, kind of leaned toward the understanding that, like, you have to find it in you to go back and call and thank God for giving you what you wanted in the first place, even though you don't necessarily, like, need to, like, you don't have the need, the physical need to say, like, I don't have this and I want it in my life.
No, I think you're right. And so the one thing we know about them is their ingratitude. To just simply come back and say thank you. There's no indication that they spent any time turning around and looking back. But that once they were healed, they just went on to whatever was next in their life. They didn't take any time to spend in contemplation for what just happened. In stark contrast to the Samaritan man. Ingratitude. In Paul's list of sins to Timothy, one of the ones he gives us is people who are ungrateful, that demonstrate ingratitude. I think this is a dangerous place for us to be. And could we ever get to a place in our lives, or maybe we've already experienced this, where we're not grateful? That we have a spirit of ingratitude toward God. I think there's an obvious correlation in this, that they're dealing with leprosy. But what's the disease that mankind suffers with? Sin, right? Sin is the thing that will destroy us. Sin is the thing that sends us to eternal destruction. Sin is the thing that we cannot cure. There is nothing you can do as a human being to cure your sin. God had to do that miraculously. In John chapter 3 and verse 16, verse 17, what does that very well-known verse say? For God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son to do what?
Whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. God sent him not to perish, I mean not to condemn the world but to save the world.
Yeah, and so when you look at that powerful text, it's so powerful because of the sacrifice of Jesus, because of the sacrifice of God. And because of the love with which motivated that. Romans 5:8 tells us, for God demonstrated his own love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The most grateful human being on the earth ought to be the redeemed Christian. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. Genesis chapter 9, after the ark had come to rest, God had opened the door, they came off the ark. The very first thing he did was, as Lisa mentioned, is he made sacrifice to thank God for bringing him through that. A sense of gratitude. I wanted to share something with you just a little bit. Now, let me warn you, this is kind of a tough message, but the church in, I think it's in Jefferson, Alabama, posted this, if I can find it here. I'm going to read just a portion. This is kind of long, but they posted this on Facebook. And this is a letter to, a loving letter, let's see, to our absentee members. Okay? So let me share a little bit. It says, "Dear brethren, we've certainly been missing you lately and are very concerned about you, though we sometimes don't know how to approach you about the matter for fear we might make the situation worse than better if we say the wrong thing and make you mad. Of course, we're not talking about those of you who have been sick and shut in, although we miss you too and are concerned about you too, howbeit with a different kind of concern. However, the focus of this letter is toward you, brethren, who have been willfully neglecting the feeding of your souls and are backsliding into a worldly lifestyle. No, we're not accusing you of gross immorality when we say you are slipping back into a worldly lifestyle. We're just very concerned for your souls because your recent absenteeism forces us to conclude you care not for assembling with the saints as the Lord commands. Can we assume you no longer wish to be a member of Christ's church? Should we remove your name from the roll of faithful members at North Jefferson? Do you think we are out of line to think of you as an unfaithful, backsliding, negligent, worldly, delinquent member of the body of Christ? If you say, 'Well, I haven't quit the church,' let us ask you, what more would you have to do or not do in order to quit the Lord's church, the Lord and His church? Your absenteeism kept you from communing with your Lord, causing you to be in clear violation of 1 Corinthians 11:26. It has kept you from offering support and encouragement to your brethren. It has limited your opportunity to praise, adore, and thank your Heavenly Father. It has kept you from supporting the Lord's work financially, since you are obviously not laying by in store on the first day of the week, 1 Corinthians 16:2. It has prevented your activity participation in the work of the church. It has brought spiritual starvation to your soul as you have absented yourself from the teaching and preaching of the bread of life. Now really, if it does not describe someone who has quit the Lord and His church, what does? If you never showed up for work, how long do you think it would be before the boss would assume you had quit your job?" And it goes on from there. And you can look that up. It's the North Jefferson Church of Christ. But I do think it's a tough but somewhat powerful message to all of us as Christians about our response to God. And what does our actions demonstrate? These nine, by simply not turning back, demonstrate what?
Ungratefulness.
What'd you say? Yes, sir. Any other terms that come to your mind?
Negligence.
What?
Expected.
Yeah. We'll explain that one for me. So kind of like pride, right? Or self-entitlement. You know, if we as Christians are baptized into Jesus, and then we go on and just kind of live our life, what does that demonstrate? I think the same kind of thing. Right? Part of why we come together is not just to get something out of the worship service. That ought not be our motivation formally. Now, there are things we get out of it, I hope. And I know if we invest ourselves, we will. But our motivation should be what? God, thank you. I was desperate. I was in need of something, and you healed me. I was sick. I was dying. I had no hope. You gave me hope. And so we come to praise God because of what He's done for us. What motivates our worship? What motivates our service? It should be our gratitude. Now, what are some distractions that can take us away from what we should be doing? You know, Satan is work. Satan is really good at getting us distracted. Now, maybe that's what happened to those 9 lepers. Maybe they got distracted, and that's why they didn't come back. I don't know. I really don't know exactly why. I know ingratitude was one of the things that motivated them. But it may have been that something happened. Maybe a family member, and they got caught up with them. Maybe they felt like they needed to be somewhere. I don't know what it was. But are there distractions that Satan can put in our way? What are some of the distractions he puts in front of us? And so we mentioned work. Any others? Is that's our one distraction?
Didn't want to get out of bed.
Didn't want to get out of bed, right?
Yes. Material things.
What?
Material things.
Maybe it was our desire for those things.
Lack of love. Because I know that's what keeps me, initially when I became a Christian 23 years ago, I came because I wanted my marriage to be. But now I go because I love God and I love His people.
Absolutely. And let me give you a couple others that come to my mind. Can our spouse be a distraction? Those who have lived in a marriage where one spouse is a member of the Lord's church and the other is either not a member or unfaithful, can that be hard? Can that cause distractions? Can your children become a distraction? You have children, you have activity in your life. Their activities, can they become a distraction? Can they become the priority over the Lord? We've mentioned several here, but whatever your distraction is, you need to be aware of it. Because the only way we overcome those things is to become aware that they are the distraction in my life. Anything that is taking me away from serving God, anything I'm putting ahead of Him is in many ways for me become my idol. It's become the thing I praise. And so you see these 9, they, for whatever reason, don't do what the Samaritan does. So let me go to this last question as we prepare to close. What was it about the Samaritan? What can we take away from his actions that led him to turn around? Because you know he was in one direction and he said, no, you know what? I'm going to come back. What was it about him? What was it about what we see in his actions that explain why he did this? Harry?
I would think he was willing to go the second mile.
Can you explain that a little bit?
The others, they said, well, we're on the way to the priest. Mm-hmm. That's what the law talked about. But he was willing to go beyond that.
He didn't let the law become a distraction.
In his heart. Mm-hmm.
Church could even become a distraction.
Yes.
The priest could have been a distraction.
Absolutely.
The law of Moses.
Absolutely, brother. Mitch?
Yeah, he said that he actually saw that he had been healed. So probably for decades he's looking at this man, poor skin, and then all of a sudden he has skin like a baby. And I mean, that's he recognized it as a miracle.
So is it important that sometimes we take note of where we come from, where God has brought us from, to think about those things? Does those give us an appreciation for what we have? Sometimes we can start to look around and think about all the things we don't have. Man, I'd like to have that. I'd like to have that. I'd like to do this. I'd like to do that. Do we take the time to think about what we do have, what we have been blessed with? We need to foster gratitude in our heart. And I think there's nothing more significantly to this parable is this idea of fostering gratitude and allowing that to fill our lives. Thank you all so much. Like I mentioned, Doug will be speaking next week, Lord willing, and he'll move us into a new discussion. Appreciate it. We'll dismiss this class and rejoin for worship in just a couple of minutes.